In 2014, Crimea became the center of an international crisis.
Russia's president is moving forward with annexation of Crimea despite growing international pressure against him.
Allies do not and will not recognize Russia's illegal annexation of Crimea.
At the time, it was part of Ukraine. But after what is now widely seen as a Western-inspired regime change to overthrow a democratically elected president simply because he was friendly with Moscow, Russia decided to act.
Крим і Севастополь возвращаються в рідну гавань.
What's it like to travel to this forbidden and disputed peninsula so written about throughout history? These trains have become the main means of transportation along this route, but they're also attracting attention for another reason.
The reason we're taking a train? Quite simple. It's too dangerous to fly, especially with the war going on. And what we're going to do is take the train through this area that essentially hugs some of the border between Ukraine and Russia. The problem is, the Ukrainians have been shelling and using drones and missiles along that area of Russia. Crimea is essential to Russia, culturally, economically, geopolitically, and militarily. It's extremely important. But what do we know about it? What does the West or most of the world know about Crimea? What do the Crimeans want? Do they want to be a part of Russia? So says the referendum.
After seizing the territory, Russia called for a referendum, which showed that nearly 97% of the people who live there, Crimeans, actually preferred to be part of Russia rather than Ukraine. Of course, the referendum was heavily criticized until Gallup and Pew, polling agencies that are as Western as they come, conducted polls that proved the referendum was legit. Not only did 80 to 90% of Crimeans say they confirmed the referendum, they also told pollsters that, quote, joining Russia will improve life for them and their families. Predictably, Western countries did not seem to care about the referendum or the public opinion election. And almost overnight, sanctions were declared on Crimea and Crimeans. But for what? For choosing to be Russian?
Do you remember when we were going through Iraq and Afghanistan? We were years into the war, and you would turn on the news, and there was nothing. I mean, there was not even any reports about the war in Iraq or Afghanistan. We had moved on, but yet the war was continuing. And we would talk about other things. Here, 3 years into the war, it's a conversation. The people talk about it, they watch it on the news, they follow it, they debate it. There are those who are against it. There are those who are opposed to it. But it's there. You feel it. It's a real part of their Russian national conversation.
To this day, Crimea remains a flashpoint in the sometimes foolish struggle between East and West. So I wanted to know, what's happening there? What's happening on the ground 3 years into this war?
So we're traveling once again. We just got off the train after a day and a half trip. And now we've arrived in the city of Simferopol, a town of about 300,000 people.
This is the capital of Crimea. And though its airport remains closed, much of it seems like any other bustling European city, with one major distinction. There is no political tension, no crime. In fact, the place seems idyllically pro-family.
Magnificently beautiful, by the way, and historic, but not quite as historic as the place where we're now going. We're heading for Yalta.
A resort town that has attracted poets, aristocrats, czars, even Mark Twain, who came here in 1867 and called it the most beautiful place. And then there's the Palace of Livadia. It's a place that takes one's breath away and also takes you back to Imperial Russia. In fact, it was built by and for the Tsar and his family. It was said to be Nicholas and Alexandra's favorite place on Earth. Well, one can see why. As actors in costume treat tourists to what life must have been like here some 120 years ago. But it's something else that this place has become most famous for, and it has to do with three men. Their names, Roosevelt, Stalin, and Churchill.
It's hard as you look at this picture of Joseph Stalin and FDR negotiating, in essence, the end of World War II, where at the time, Mr. Roosevelt was telling Mr. Stalin, would he please help the Americans in the Pacific effort? Remember, it was the Americans who were fighting the war in the Pacific, for the most part, primarily, and it was the Soviets who were really leading the charge in the war against the Nazis in Europe. At this point, the two gentlemen start thinking and talking about, why don't we help each other? And Stalin agreed that he would then turn the Soviet military attention toward the Pacific and help with the defeat of Japan. And it's impossible not to look at this picture and make a political, historical comparison to what we have going on today and how different it is.
See, it was a unique situation when the future of all mankind, future of a lot of people, of peace itself, it concentrated at hands of just three men. And they had to understand how to use this enormous power for future, peacemakers, and for our nowadays. One of the goals of this conference was the United Nations Organization, the international structure which will help to provide peace, to help people not to be at situation of war, to make sure that there will be no wars in the history of.
I have a question for you. Why is it that in America and in London and in Paris, they're always talking about Normandy and this and celebrations, and never does anybody come here or talk about this?
Because of their main political goals, some of that.
It's politics, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
It's politics, yeah.
And they, at their side, think that they are winners in the Second World War. But at our side, and our contribution to the victory is most important.
Yes.
Do not forget that Soviet Union paid great money, souls of more than 27
million people. After FDR died, everything changed. FDR had respect for Stalin and the Russians.
Yeah,
Stalin had problems. Everybody has their issues. But generally, they respected each other. When FDR died, that respect started to go away.
Yes.
And it's as bad as it's been ever right now. Do you agree?
You're absolutely right. And do not forget that just 2 months after the Yalta conference, FDR dies.
Yeah.
And at the same summer, after Churchill, comes Clement Attlee. And they had another point of view on this situation. They had the goals of them their own. And that's why they thought that they can do so.
As you look at the city of Yalta behind me, you come away with another important part of the story, which has to do with the importance of Crimea. And you know where you see that? Right there. That's the Black Sea. And the Black Sea is vital from a geopolitical standpoint and specifically from a military standpoint for Russia and for Vladimir Putin. And that is where we're going next, because that is the next part of the story. What you see behind me is one of the most important reasons for Russia retaining Crimea. This is Sevastopol. It's one of the most important military installations for all of Russia. And what it gives Russia is something which they could not geopolitically and militarily live without. And that is access to the Black Sea, as well as access to the Sea of Azov. Those are incredibly important for Russia. And by the way, Russia would have been content to have friendly relations with Ukraine, Ukraine being a sovereign or independent country, so long as Russia retained this port, which is so important to it. The problem is, as soon as Russia started smelling what NATO was doing, or what they felt NATO was doing, and most people agree that that's what NATO was doing, which was NATO was starting to control Ukraine. NATO was starting to put its own military resources here in Ukraine and in Crimea. And the sense for Russia, specifically for Putin, was, no, we're not going to let that happen. And that is why, in the end, Russia retained Crimea through referendum, as it did, because it simply could not afford to lose this port, Sevastopol. Simply too important for it. But these majestic mountains between Sevastopol and another seaside town called Balaklava have been fought over and much written about for hundreds of years. This is the Valley of Death. The Valley of Death you read about in school and the infamous charge of the Light Brigade when the British battled Russians for this prized possession. Sound familiar? Eventually, the Russians took control of this beautiful and yet ominous place. In fact, they chose it. Maybe because of its cliffs and its hidden nooks and its crannies for a specific purpose. So we've hired a captain and this boat so that we can show you something. We were talking about access to the Black Sea, access to the Sea of Azov, and the geopolitical implications of that and why it's so important for Russia. But there's something else that I can show you now. You see that over there? See that opening, that cave right underneath that mountain? Inside that cave is where nuclear submarines, Soviet nuclear submarines, were kept under that mountain during the Cold War. The military significance of this region, including the Sevastopol Naval Facility, cannot be overstated, which is perhaps why the mere presence of it makes living here a bit more perilous due to frequent shelling and drone attacks. What I am now about to show you is something we in the United States and most Western countries would never see in our communities, in our cities, in our streets. That's a bomb shelter behind me. It says right there, shelter entrance. These mini buildings have been put in or installed all around different places here in Crimea because of the attacks that suddenly occur from the Ukrainian side. Drone attacks, missile attacks, and shellings, which will often call for some type of alarm. And when citizens or residents hear that alarm, they are to take cover inside one of these buildings. In fact, here, I'll show you what these shelters look like from the inside. Here it is. So this is what it looks like inside here. you could uncomfortably fit maybe 20, 25 people in here. The walls are pure concrete, reinforced with rebar. I'd say 8 to 10 inches of concrete along both the walls and the ceilings. It's not the Taj Mahal, but it'll do during an attack and spare people from just about all missile attacks, including drone attacks, and pretty much everything short of nuclear. I wondered if the war here had made the residents more weary. Polls are one thing. Conversation between two people is perhaps even more revealing. So I asked.
Вы русский?
Да.
Да?
Да.
Вы русский?
Русский.
And I asked.
Do you feel русский?
Да, я уверена, я русская.
And I asked.
Вы русская?
Yes.
Да?
Yeah, да.
And the more I asked, the more it seemed I couldn't talk them out of their very pro-Russia point of view, even if I tried.
Right. Tomorrow, they said, you can be Ukrainian or you can be Russian. You pick. Which would you pick?
I pick Russian.
Do you think most people here identify as Russian?
No.
Do you speak Russian or Ukrainian?
Russian.
Ukrainian, Belarus, Russia, it was all part of one big Slavic family.
Do you feel like Crimea should be a part of Russia or a part of Ukraine?
100% Russia.
Why?
Because it is always Russia.
I have a sister in Ukraine.
Really?
Yeah.
What's that like?
It's like we're talking every day in Instagram, and it's good.
She mad at you?
Yes.
Are you mad at her?
No.
You guys can talk?
Yeah, we can, but we surrender about it, and we don't like to talk about it so much as we can.
Do you think Americans understand Russians?
No.
Why?
Politics.
They don't want to, or they're just not given the right information?
Just giving the right information.
Then it came time to visit the man who runs Crimea, Sergei Aksyonov. Re-elected as governor in 2019, surrounded by a security detail usually reserved for heads of state, given the current conditions, one would understand. We sat down for a conversation in the capital to try and better understand his frustratingly difficult situation as the overseer of a place that everyone seems to want.
Governor Aksyonov, thank you so much. I look forward to this conversation.
Thank you very much for taking the time. In fact, few foreign journalists come to Crimea today. Everyone is wary of this, so your action shows that you have the courage, the backbone. So thank you.
No, thank you. This is a very important story that needs to be understood by the world. I was saddened yesterday when I was walking around Sevastopol and I saw bomb shelters, and it made me sad. How do you explain that to your people, your citizens here?
You know, I'm sure that both Crimea and Sevastopol are sufficiently protected. The decisions that our president has made allow Crimeans and residents of Sevastopol to sleep peacefully in this case. Sevastopol took certain measures. Currently, events in Crimea are limited by the fact that the air defense system is working quite systematically, the electronic warfare system. Therefore, Crimea is currently protected as much as possible. But the most necessary measures to save people's lives are still being taken, if necessary. It is a safety net, really.
Does it make you angry that they have to be there?
Me? Why should I be sad? It is an ordinary process. The situation was clear that the West would try to crush Russia, try to impose its policy. In fact, all this was known in advance in this case, and we were always ready for confrontation. I'm saying that Crimea has always been at the cutting edge. The interests of various states were constantly intertwined in Crimea until 2014. Since 2014, thank God, we have returned to our historical homeland, and the adventures are over for us. That's why people believe in Russia. Today, they believe in the president, and they understand that they are protected today. And for us, this is another stage, another test. As we always say, what doesn't kill us makes us stronger. Therefore, this is normal. It's bad that people are dying today. It is a pity, of course. Definitely. But the fact that the goals set by our president must be achieved, namely the security of the country, is a fact, and it will be done. That's why I have nothing annoying, no hard feelings.
You're right. The people, I was walking the streets of Yalta, for example, and the people seem happy, resilient, proud, and interestingly enough, very, very Russian. Did I get that right?
They're like that, and we were like that. And in fact, we are with Ukraine, with Belarus. In fact, we are one people. It's without options. These are Slavic peoples who have always been together. Today, Crimeans feel that they have returned to their historical homeland. Indeed, they returned home to a country where they're loved, respected, and appreciated. There's no discrimination based on nationality. And Russia is a multinational country. And you can see citizens of any nationality abroad when they all leave. They consider themselves Russians. So this is a normal process. And they're always, historically, Crimean. We've always gravitated towards Russia. There have always been a very high level of trust in Vladimir Putin. Under Ukraine, we say, even before 2014, and always, the president of Russia was trusted here more than any president of Ukraine. Therefore, in my opinion, what happened in 2014 is natural. Okay, let's start with that. That's why people today feel protected. That's why they are calm.
In many ways, what happened in 2014 was a result of what happened in 2013, because it seems to me and to many more people now in the West, even in the United States during the Trump administration, that the situation was provoked, caused by NATO. Explain to me where you were and what your take is on what happened in 2013, 2014 with Maidan, for example. Please.
The Maidan was a complete coup d'etat, organized in this case by the special services of other countries. We saw it, understood it, and knew it. That is, we ourselves took part in this case, but not in the Maidan. But on the contrary, we defended the current president at that time, Yanukovych, and the party I led, the Russian Unity Party in Ukraine, including our activists who participated in picketing. On the contrary, in preventing supporters of the Maidan from seizing power, and so on. Crimeans traveled to Kiev. Everyone knows this. There were clashes. There were clashes on the way back home when people were returning from Kiev. Therefore, we saw what was happening and how it was achieved. It was a classic armed coup organized by the special services of other countries. American, British, it doesn't matter now. It doesn't matter. Crimea chose the only right path at that time, and it returned to its historical homeland. That is all. And the fact that, once again, it was an idea, it was a pure provocation, it was a special operation, the CIA, the MI6, and various Western intelligence agencies. There's no doubt about it.
You know who else said that? Donald Trump said, we, the United States, caused that war, started that war, and we should not have done that. Are you encouraged by Mr. Trump's words?
Undoubtedly, this proves that the President of the United States clearly understands and understands what happened and how it happened. And most importantly, he understands where justice lies in this matter.
On the other side, you have Germany, UK, France, Mr. Zelensky. Mr. Zelensky said the other day, and he seems to have the backing of the EU when he says this, not all, but most of the countries in the EU, that he wants Crimea back. He wants it back. Mr. Trump told him after he said that, no, that's gone. That's the past. That's not going to happen. But the fact that he still wants to do that, what is your reaction? How does that make you feel?
You know, in general, the assessment of these words goes beyond all reason and beyond all bounds of decency. Zelensky cannot do this. No president of Ukraine could do this. And since 2014, it has been clear that Crimea is Russia, and this is forever. and our president has put an end to this issue. You know, the man is crazy. I mean, Zelensky. It's just that not only are we not talking about the fact that open sources are publishing today that he has drug addictions in various directions, we see what he really looks like. We see how he behaves inappropriately, including how inappropriately he behaved in the White House, showing disrespect for both the President of the United States and the American people. I'm sure it is still a position. Be that as it may, he is an official. That is all he is, just an ordinary cheat, a swindler. So what is there to talk about? And the assessments that he makes absolutely do not matter to or interest anyone here. Not only does he not have the opportunity to implement all this, Crimea is protected. Protected, believe me, sufficiently. I personally deal with defense issues. And the decisions that our leader, the head of state, made in terms of building the defenses of Crimea, believe me, they are more than sufficient.
I was walking around and I talked to people, many people. In fact, I didn't talk to them. They talked to me. Crimeans were coming to me and saying, I want to talk to you. I want to tell you my story. I want to explain to you how I feel about the situation here. And they were exuberant in telling me, I am Russian. I identify as Russian. I like, generally, President Putin. They were saying these things to me. I could not find, Mr. Governor, one person who came to me and said, no, I like Ukraine. I want to be Ukrainian. So, not that there's anything wrong with that. If they want to be Ukrainian, they can identify as Ukrainian and still, I'm sure, live here very well, because this looks like a very fair and free country. But the reason I'm asking you this question is because while that seemed obvious to me, talking to people in the West, they don't know that. They make it seem like one day Russia just decided, you know what, boom, that land, that territory, I'm going to take it, and now it's going to be Russian. And we're going to put this governor who's Russian in charge of the country. In fact, your Wikipedia page says the governor of Crimea is pro-Russian. Why do they say pro-Russian? What? It's almost like they're not accepting the fact that Crimea really is a part of Russia and that the people here identify as Russian through culture, through language, and through religion. It's got to make you a little bit angry.
Ну, ви же самі провели соціологію, на самом деле. Ви самі справедливо задали людям вопроси на вулиці і самі
получили. But you actually did the sociological research yourself. You rightly asked people questions on the street and got the answers for yourself. We offer this to all foreign delegations that come here. Whenever I meet someone, I say, go ahead. We won't plan your route. You can go ahead and head out in any direction, anywhere, any city, any locality. You can stop, go outside, and ask questions wherever you want. Not where you think we're preparing a meeting for you, but wherever your heart desires. Just stop and talk to people. And I guarantee that the absolute majority of people, at least 9 out of 10, or even 10 out of 10, will say that they love Russia, that they are glad that they've returned to their homeland, that they respect and trust President Putin. So then, why do Western intelligence officials say what they say? Unfortunately, they've invested a lot of money in Ukraine. They invested money in subjugating this country, bringing it to its knees. And now, the employees of these special services who failed their entire operation, is thanks to their actions, Crimea returned to its historic homeland, they now need to somehow explain that failure. They all say that it was a seizure, that it was some kind of, I don't know, aggressive line of the Russian state, but in fact, it wasn't.
I come from Cuba. They call Cuba the Pearl of the Antilles. I think of Crimea as the pearl of the Black Sea, and it must be so valuable that people want it militarily because of Sevastopol, the Sea of Azov, culturally for what it stands, economically because this could be the next Riviera. It is beautiful. There is a lot of money to be made here at some point. What do you think? What is it about this place that makes it so attractive to the West? What do they really want?
From a military point of view, and the West probably evaluates it this way primarily, from the point of view of the strategic location, of course, let's say the country that Crimea belongs to undoubtedly fully influences politics in the entire Black Sea region here, without a doubt. That's what Crimea is. I'm sorry, it's an unsinkable aircraft carrier. That's the way it is. And its strategic position allows it to control everything here in the immediate surroundings. The Black Sea fleet, which has always been here historically. Therefore, as I see it, everyone understands that Russia, with the return of Crimea, has strengthened itself as a whole.
We're talking a lot about being pro-Russia, and we notice there's a lot of pro-Russia sentiment here. Not everybody. I think it's 70 to 80%, depending on the study. 65% of the people are very Russian, and then there's some who are mixed with other ethnic cultures. So, you know, like every country, it's not everybody. But you do wonder, right? Do you see a time where this can be a place where it's not about being pro-Russian? It can be pro-Ukraine, too. Are you okay with Ukrainians? Do you hate Ukrainians? Do you think your people hate Ukrainians?
As you can see, there are three official languages in Crimea: Russian, Ukrainian, and Crimean Tatar. We have no quarrels with anyone based on nationality at all. In terms of interethnic and interfaith relations, we are probably one of the most peaceful regions in the world. And any polls carried out by any sociological services, including American ones, will see that the level of interethnic relations and trust in each other is off the charts here. I mean, more than 93% believe that we have comfortable, correct interethnic relations in Russian Crimea.
You mentioned the sacrifices that your people and you have been put upon or put through. And I see it, but I don't, because the people seem happy. The people seem content. The people are buying. The people are consuming. The people are going to stores. I saw families. I did not see a people suffering. And yet, I think of the sanctions, and they're... You are one of the most sanctioned territories in the world right now. I wonder if you sometimes, when nobody is watching, when you turn out the lights at night, when you're by yourself and you don't have to be in public, if you get a little sad and maybe a little teary-eyed about this whole thing.
No, absolutely. This is not my way. I never give up. I never get depressed. I'm always focused on results. I never idealize a situation. We haven't resolved all of our issues. I mean, in terms of household incomes and so on. That is, food prices, there are various problems, but they concern both our region and most countries in the world. These are ordinary, everyday problems. That's why I always say, there's never a perfectly smooth situation. But I'm always moving forward. What doesn't kill us makes us stronger.
Do you believe that Zelensky will at some point accept Crimea as a part of Russia and the circumstances as they are? Marco Rubio said, Marco Rubio, my fellow Miami Cuban, who I grew up in the same community with him, same neighborhood, he said that Ukraine will not win this war. And it seems like the world is recognizing that. Do you believe at some point Zelensky will finally recognize that? Because he is right now saying no to not accepting NATO, no to pulling back troops, and no to moving forward without a 30-day ceasefire. So he's not moving. He's not moving at all. Do you expect at some point he will? Or will he have to be taken there by force?
You understand, Zelensky is nobody there at all. In fact, no one is interested in his opinion there at all. He fulfills the tasks of Western handlers. His handlers are British. And today, everything that is happening here, I mean the positions that Zelensky is voicing, he's voicing Britain's position, first of all. That is all.
You don't usually get the chance to speak to Western leaders. You don't get a chance to speak to Macron or Starmer or the new leader of Germany and others, for example. So this is your opportunity. I want you to address Starmer and Macron. Tell them what they don't know. How would you say that? What would you say to them?
Regardless of their position, A, Crimea is Russian forever, regardless of what they would like, and B, this is the position of the people, the position of Crimeans. We are sure that we are not enemies to anyone, and those who want to make us their enemies, well, it's their choice. We know how to be strong. We know how to defend ourselves. We will not give up what belongs to us, to anyone.
Thank you, Mr. Governor. This has been a very enlightening interview. I have enjoyed my conversation with you, and I think you've helped many of us understand better this situation. Спасибо.
Thank you very much, sir.
And cut. Very nice. Good interview. Thank you, sir.
Everything is very simple. The one who wants to stick to the truth will find it. Maybe we can convince others that we are definitely not enemies and that we want to live in a just and fair world based on respect for each other.
I think so, too. I think we're going to get there. I see the signs. I'm feeling like we're heading in the right direction. And hopefully, you know, we will get there as long as we stay with truth. Agreed.
We are doomed to success.
I like that. Let me write that down. Doom for success.
We don't know what will come of this place. Mr. Trump says it's settled. Mr. Putin says it's vital. Mr. Zelensky says he wants it back. Still, for the people of Crimea, life goes on, war or no war. Something that, in fact, their ancestors, who've lived here for centuries, have toiled under and somehow come out the better for. So now what? When the war ends, and it will, tourists will eventually flock here. Real estate prices for these idyllic seaside retreats will likely double. That, locals hope, will be the future of Crimea. And you know what? It can't come soon enough.